Hello and welcome to Say That, the podcast where your big questions get real answers. My name is Matt King. I'm your host here in the city of Chicago. Joining us here is Jeb Brewer.
For now, we'll see what happens in the next 24 hours.
Indeed we will. With us all the way from Rutgers, Tennessee is Lee Younger.
I see you guys now, but what if something was to obstruct my view and I were no longer able to see you?
What indeed?
Say That, a podcast with a fundamental misunderstanding of what an eclipse is.
What?
An eclipse is when you can't see Jed anymore. That's also what happens when the Zoom chat crashes.
Nothing we could do. A total eclipse of the Jed.
Actually, my FaceTime setup right now, where Jed is on the preview and my little like window where I can see myself is covering up 3/4 of Jed's face. And then I just have like a giant space of the room that Jed is in, totally unobscured by my own view of my stupid self. I got more Jed. He moved.
Yeah.
Yes. To paint a picture for the listening audience, Lee and I are both kind of, as you would expect, someone sitting at a desk with a FaceTime, just kind of set it up. But Jed has chosen a more artistic tack. He's gone for the kind of more Kubrick-esque. He's only in the very bottom corner sixth of his square, and he's letting the rest be filled with atmospheric shots.
Jed's such an artiste that he can't be in the center of a Zoom call. He has to obey the rule of thirds even in a Zoom call.
It's so true. The other element is that I am recording in my office, which is a recording studio, and there is so much stuff in here that there's literally nowhere else I can put a phone. So it's, you know, at a certain point, it just all breaks down.
Yeah, it certainly does. And maybe it breaks down to the point where it would be an emergency.
What?
Whoa.
Which, as Lee and Jed have alluded to, we record this on the evening of Sunday, April the 7th. And tomorrow is going to be a lunar eclipse, but there's some people who are out there just asking questions. I go to a post from r/Christianity, which, sure. Subreddit r/Christianity. Headline, is the April 8th eclipse going to be the rapture? I've seen many videos all over the internet saying the eclipse is going to be the second coming of Christ, and also the red heifer and the two broods of the cicadas. Me personally, I don't believe that this will be the second coming of Jesus, but I'd like to hear other opinions. I mean, there's really only the two opinions, either it will or won't.
What's the red heifer, man? That really took me by surprise.
Yeah, same here.
I think there's a verse, or maybe it's just an apocrypha, about a red heifer. let me see if I can find this.
Is this a metal band?
Could be. In Numbers 19, the Israelites are commanded to obtain, quote, a red heifer without spot, wherein there is no blemish, and upon never came a yoke. And the heifer is to be slaughtered and burned outside the camp. So that's like one of the animal sacrifices. So apparently in like crazy pants, what's his name? John Hagee, like weird, you know, evangelicals who are obsessed with Israel. There's a thing where it's like, well, this is one of the things that has to happen before the end prophecy is the temple has to be rebuilt and they have to be red heifers in Jerusalem so that they can be slaughtered to the point where enterprising people in the Middle East have taken to breeding red heifers because they're like, this will get these yokels involved. And there are people floating pictures of themselves being in Israel right now being like, here's me with the red heifers. It's all going down, y'all.
Wow.
So yeah, it's the main thing is to remember is that everything is normal.
Yeah.
So we got that. Wow. We also had the earthquake in the New York area, which several of our finest scientific and theological minds threw in there to point out any number of insane things, one of them being it's the end of the world.
Sure.
Because we've never had earthquakes or eclipses.
It's just going great. This is a golden age for reasoned discussion. That's the key thing.
I will say, I go back to our friend here at r/Christianity who posted this thread. And I will say, I think this is the closest to a relatable and fair-headed take on such things that I've ever seen, which is, a lot of people are saying this. I don't really think it's going to happen. Maybe. I'd like a lot more of that if we have to have rapture discourse.
Yeah. Yeah, the level of discourse. That's really what's interesting to me here, is the level of discourse is like, you know, we have a little earthquake. We've got a little eclipse going on, and people who supposedly, by the way, love the Bible are immediately like, this must be the return of the Christ. When Jesus himself said, no one will know when it's going to happen. I don't even know.
Well, maybe if he took the time to do the numerology, he would know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Speaking of such things, here's an interesting fact I learned this week. Apparently we can trace a lot of the, you know, tribulation, millennialism, whatever, like the idea of the rapture, as you would think of it if you heard it in church growing up, to one dude who did his own translations of the Bible. I would give you a hint on the timing. It was in America, so
certainly,
post late 18th century. Do you guys have any guesses on when the rapture was invented?
I'm thinking this is William Miller.
This is not the Millerites, though. A lot of overlap. Okay. This was I'm going to sarcastically use the term gentleman, John Nelson Darby in 1833.
Yeah.
So,
didn't happen then, pal.
But there's a red cow. That's slightly irregular.
I'm glad that Jed referenced the total eclipse of the heart, because what we need is a good rock song with this, you know, this apocalyptic eclipse, this apocalypse.
Yeah, we do. Yeah, we do.
You know, we need a good rock song, and I think a metal band that's called Red Heifer would give us the appropriate rock song. There's a old friend of the show, Charlie Job, was hanging out with his 16-year-old daughter, Dylan, and she was getting into some metal. And so he just like started some random metal, like super, you know, heavy metal playlist on Spotify. And he said, all of a sudden she started laughing, and he looked down at the heads up display on the car, and he said, the name of the band, I cannot repeat to you. But my 16-year-old daughter found it hilarious. And I was like, well, now I want to call Jed and find out what the name of this band was. And he said, I cannot say the name of this band out loud, but I would really be interested to see what the band Red Heifer would come up with as a Cookie Monster metal, or a, you know, Swedish death metal, or whatever brand of metal to describe the apocalypse.
Oh man. So we're thinking full on Cookie Monster metal here.
Totally, dude. We're this is the end of the world, Jed. Don't mess around.
I think what that brings to mind to me is someone trying to do the full on death metal cover of the REM song, It's the End of the World as We Know It. And at some point their throat just exploding from trying to do that many words that quickly in that voice.
Wow.
Well, hold on a second. Let me see what I can do.
Oh,
that was a dramatic sip of bubbly sparkling water for those of you listening along at home.
The Matt King's wry smile was
the
fantastic.
Grapefruit flavor, I believe.
Let's see.
Pamplemousse, for those of you who are a little fancier.
Oh, très fancy. Let me see what I can do. That's great. It starts with that earthquake. Burst the snakes and aeroplanes. Let it brow since Lord of Rain. I am a hurricane. Listen to yourself. Shirt, word size and sound. Needs, don't misserve your own needs. Speed it up and not speed. Grunt, no strength. The letters of star. Fear of high, down high. With the fire. Represent the seven games. And a government for hire. And a cabinet of sight. Left ear wants to keep it in a hurry. With the fury spreading down your neck.
Wow. Now, I think that was a first in a number of ways. Not the least of which, I think that's the only time the words Lenny Bruce have been said in that voice. The rest of them, maybe other times, but Lenny Bruce, that was comfortable calling that one a world first.
Jed, that was terrifying and amazing.
Yeah. On the theme of heavy music, Jed did send us, said Lee and I earlier in the week, the kind of most listened to of a metal friend of his. And there's at least two names on here, bands that I cannot say, but the rest, which I think we'll all enjoy, Carnifex.
Yeah.
Which I think is good. Infant Annihilator.
Shrine of Malice.
Shadow of Intent, which sounds like a 90s thriller movie. Like,
nah, dude, that's
from the
pulp
writer
novel
of the Pelican Brief. Shadow of Intent.
That's a pulp investigator detective novel from the 40s, man.
Yeah, that's got a real Maltese Falcon view to it. Some of the song titles: Final Judgment, Necromantium, which I assume is a combination of kind of necromancy and momentum.
Sure, or adamantium.
Yeah, that's true.
Slash an amusement park ride at like a really weird amusement park.
Sure, at Goth Carowinds, you can ride the Necromantium. And short and simple, Beelzebub. It's still funny, but I feel like you weren't trying on that one, metal people.
Yeah, that's a little on the nose, but I appreciate the hustle.
Yeah. So in the incipient number of possible signs of the end of all things, I'm going to add a death metal cover of The End of the World as We Know It.
Certainly.
Did you guys get any Eclipse sunglasses?
Not yet.
We're pretty much betting on the fact that it's going to be gray enough here that we can't see it.
Is Illinois in the path of convergence or whatever?
Southern Illinois is. They're the bustling metropolis of Carbondale, Illinois, is apparently right in the smack middle of it and expecting some like 100,000 visitors.
That's totally insane.
Because there is some kind of caveman-esque biological drive to look at the sky when something weird is happening. And that's cool.
Yeah, that's true.
what I wish is that if you got official Eclipse glasses, that they came with earbuds, and all you heard was that thing that Jed just did on repeat.
Not song.
Just that thing.
My question, going back to where Lee started us on down the music path, is how many middle school teachers / guys our age who are doing youth work will be at their Eclipse party and play Total Eclipse of the Heart from their Bluetooth speaker to a sea of confounded 15-year-olds?
Quite a few.
Because you've never experienced that song before. You do not know what to make of that.
Matt, you know who else had an experience where the sun went dark at noon?
Oh!
Did that sun stay dark, Lee? Or did something happen? Maybe you feel like there's an eclipse inside of you and you need your light restored.
Wow.
There's going to be an altar call at some Eclipse party in like Kentucky, isn't there?
This is just for me and Matt, but it's going to be Dabo Swinney. He's going to be the one to do it.
I think there's a chance the Dabo Swinney, who is the head coach of the Clemson Tigers college football team, and a man who coined the term, we run our football team on NIL, the Lord's name, image, and likeness. The thing he said wearing a pink suit at a fundraising event. But there's a certain level of person, I think Coach Swinney might be on there, where I think they just have to lock him, distract him into a windowless room. Because there's a chance if he sees the moon eat the sun, he's going to actually lose his mind. Like, there's people who kind of, oh, maybe it's the end times, or maybe I want it to be the end times. Then there's people who, even if the news is on and other people are explaining to them what a solar eclipse is, they're going to experience it as the end of times.
Can I ask a question? Can the phrase "the moon ate the sun" be the chorus of Jed's Cookie Monster song?
Sure, almost
it is now. That's a green light song recording right there.
Sure. That's deep in the REM catalog. Night Swimming, because the moon ate the sun.
Well done, sir.
Well, due to the time shifted nature of the podcast medium, it's possible we're recording this before the rapture, and you, the listening audience, are only hearing it after the rapture, meaning either you got left behind and Podbean servers stayed functional through the rapture,
which is kind of amazing.
It's pretty good. Or they played the Say That podcast in the great beyond, which would be fun for us too.
Sure.
Yes,
absolutely.
That's long-term podcast planning. And on that note, we will declare emergency off.
Wow. I always wanted to podcast into the great beyond.
There's a lot going on there. You know, the podcast sponsorships are a weird thing. Maybe we can work out. Maybe we can get somebody. You know, like those, the online church of the eternal light or whatever, that will just do ordinations if you give them $4. So you can like, be the officiant of your friend's wedding. Maybe through some similar kind of chicanery, we can become the official podcast of somebody's conception of heaven.
Fantastic.
I'm Jed Brewer, and welcome to today's episode of This Heavenly Life. Today, we're going to look at a story. The Archangel Gabriel, he's famous for blowing his trumpet, but has he always wanted to blow a trumpet? Was there another vision that he had in a previous eternity? We'll get into that, but first, a word from our sponsor, Blue Apron.
That's right. This is the eternal land of milk and honey, where people don't hunger or thirst, but you can't get 20% off if you enter our coupon code off your first box of food that you don't need. I do like the idea that there's a WBEZ in the great beyond that still does the pledge drive breaks.
Oh yeah, yeah. You got to. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just enter the code Crystal C for your 20% off your first order.
You don't want to know how long Ira Glass's dramatic pauses would be if he had literally eternity to work with.
Wow. Wow, dude. I just got tired.
Like, before he entered, there would be, you know, the birth and death of stars in between the end of the setup of the third act turn. And when the twist comes.
That's funny, man.
Eyes not seen, ears not heard, nor entered into the AirPods of man. Level of those pauses.
The AirPods of man. Yeah.
That was perfect. Yeah.
Exactly. I like the idea of just there just being another kind of, if the Bible was written today and all these all the heaven similes were kind of upgraded, you know, as opposed to it's a land where you know, you will reap and not sow, but it's a land where your devices are always charged.
The Wi-Fi is always ample.
That's right. Your earpods, your earbuds never unpair randomly while you're listening to something.
The cloud never loses functionality.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So, hey, we've been off for a couple of weeks, so we're getting back in the swing of it. We forgot how to do the transition into the questions, but that's okay, because we're there now. If you have a question for us, you can hang on this all the way to the end, or you can scroll down your episode description, click the links you find there. Our first question comes in this week and says, I hear people talking about God preparing their heart for something. What does that mean? Is that any different than preparing myself for something? I think it is a fantastic question. Thank you very much for writing in. And Jed, where do we kick off here?
I have no idea what that means. So you're in a good boat.
Yeah, that is a statement about that bit of a Christian wordsmithing, not about the way you described it. You're a question asker. But I do for season six here, we're going aggressive, Jed. I don't know. What does that even mean anyway?
Yeah. No, your question makes sense, but the phrase, I don't know what that means, man. Like, I did a little, you know, Bible Gateway searching, and I couldn't find anything in the Bible that had like that phraseology to it. So the following is pure conjecture on my part, but that sounds a whole lot like someone was in a pastor's office and was like, man, I'm going through a hard time and it feels like I'm just waiting on all this stuff that I really want to see happen and none of it's working out right now. And man, what does it all mean? And that some really exhausted pastor that's just out of, you know, good advice to give is like, I don't know, Steve, maybe God's, I don't know, maybe God's preparing your heart. Like maybe that's what this is. And the guy was like, okay. And then that pastor wrote a book and now we all have to hear that phrase. I mean, I don't know that, but I think that that's certainly well within the realm of possibility. But all that said, given that I don't know what that phrase means, what I can say, and this part is important, is most good things in life do require preparation.
Yeah.
Most good things in life don't work where you do nothing to get ready, you do nothing to plan, you do nothing to prepare, and then one day it just switches on and it's great. In fact, I would say that the better and more significant and more impactful that something is in your life, the more preparation is probably required in order to be a part of it and have it be a good thing. And that's actually a, kind of another variable on all this, is that a good thing that you're not prepared for kind of isn't a good thing anymore. It's generally just kind of a mess. As an example of that, I've been super fortunate in my life to have gotten to do a bit of scuba diving. And man, that's super cool. It's really great. It's a lot of fun. You should not do that without preparing. That would be a really bad idea. You should for sure prepare. I can't underscore that enough. You know, similarly, you know, if you have the opportunity to travel to a country outside of the country that you are originally from, that can be a really, really cool thing. You shouldn't do that without preparing for it, because you will find yourself running afoul of like laws and, you know, have significant problems. So given that, again, a lot, really all good things in life generally involve some kind of preparation, it certainly makes sense to me that big picture preparation in our lives for a person of faith should involve God in that process. You know, the one of the key things about the Christian life is that it's meant to be a shared life between you and God. It's meant to be a life where you and God are on a team and figuring things out together and doing things together. And at least that's been my experience. And so if you're preparing for stuff, certainly that ought to involve God. What the details look like on that are bound to vary probably almost infinitely. There's not going to be a one-size-fits-all scenario there. And that kind of, in a way, takes us back to where we started and kind of the one other thing I'd want to encourage you to think about. Again, I don't know what the phrase God preparing their heart means. Jokey questions about the origin aside, that sounds to me a lot like a phrase that is used when people are understandably tired of waiting for important things as a way of saying, oh, well, you shouldn't be tired and frustrated. You should decide that it's holy in some way. Here's the thing. Waiting sucks. Waiting for things that you care about sucks. Waiting for things that are important to you is really painful. And particularly when you're waiting on things where it may not come. This may not just be waiting. This may be maybe my desires are not going to get realized and I have to deal with like an existential disappointment. And if you are dealing with that, I'm sorry. If you're waiting on something that's really important to you and it's breaking your heart, man, I'm sorry, truly. And if you're waiting on something where you don't know if it's going to work out or not, and so there's that sense of kind of creeping despair, I'm really, really sorry. And the thing that I want you to know is the idea that God is waiting for you to get to some sort of level of holiness before he will, you know, open the floodgates of the things that you actually want in your life, that's a pretty damn hurtful thing for people to tell you. And if you've got people telling you that, I'm sorry. There's all kinds of things in life that take a heck of a lot longer than I would want for you, than you would want for you. And I don't know the mind of God, but I cannot imagine that the right response, for example, to a child that is going hungry and they are crying because they're hungry is, well, God is preparing your heart before you can have more food. So you should just be grateful for that experience of hunger. Like, that's something only a monster would say. And so if you've got people saying that in your life, I'm sorry, and we may want to try and find other people who can be spiritual counselors to you.
Thank you, Jed, for that awful, awful thing that someone has almost certainly said. That's
I do what I can.
Insightful and depressing. The Jed Brewer special. That's the promise this podcast makes. We go like, they're right about that. Aww. All great stuff there. And Lee, maybe let's switch gears here. And if, as Jed is saying, this is just kind of the normal Christian-y pablum, but there is something to be said for being in a place where you're waiting on something, doing what you can to prepare yourself. Presumably, it would be a good thing to have God be part of that process of preparing for something. So what does that look like in an actually healthy way?
Yeah, certainly. I think about just kind of preparing yourself for anything that you would go into. If we take this out of the realm of Christianity whatsoever, if you were preparing for a trip that you were going on, then what you would probably do is like, hey, do I know anybody who has ever been to that place? So let's say I was going to prepare to go on a trip to Germany. Well, I would probably call Jed's wife, Hallie, and I would say, tell me about Germany. What are some things that I should be heads up about if I travel to that country? And what are some amazing foods that I should try to score while I'm there and stuff like that? If I were going to go into a specific kind of surgery that I'd never had, I would look for somebody in my life who had been through that surgery, and I would say, tell me about your experience. So the first thing I would do is I would look for someone who's had that experience if I was preparing for something, and I would adjust my expectations of what that thing might look like before I go into it. I would adjust my expectations based on someone who's had experiences. Getting prepared for a situation might actually involve some training. This is really weird, but Matt and I both have a friend who has competed in and then found success in a type of ultra marathon that no human being should ever attempt and ever. And it's this bizarre race that takes place in the woods in the state of Tennessee here in the States. And it's like a 130-mile race in the woods, and you have to complete it in 60 hours. And like 30 people have ever completed it in 20 something years. And there's a friend that Matt and I both have that has completed it now 3 times, and he failed a couple times before he completed it. It's ludicrous. It destroys people. It's a crazy race, but there's a lot of training involved if you're going to do something like that. Now, take that in any kind of situation in your life. There's something that I have a goal to do, but I've never done it, and I don't know how to do it. I'm going to need to prepare. What do I need to do? I need to talk to someone who's been there, who's experienced that thing, and I need to adjust my expectations about whatever I thought it was going to be based on that advice. And then I might need to train myself or prepare myself for certain things. I was thinking about this, and the closest I could come to the phrase that you've sent us in the scriptures is a place in the book of 1 Peter chapter 1. And the apostle Peter, which he was one of the 12 disciples, he was in the city of Rome when he wrote the letter of 1 Peter. And he uses a phrase that says, preparing your hearts. That's not exactly preparing your mind. He says preparing your minds. It's not the exact same thing as preparing your hearts. But the phrase that he uses in the Greek language is a phrase that was used about Roman soldiers, which he was in Rome at the time. And when Roman soldiers had a certain kind of uniform that they wore, and when they would go into battle, they had these skirts that they wore, and they would take the skirts and they would wrap them up and tuck them into their belt before they ran into battle because they had these long skirts that they wore. And sounds pretty groovy to me, but they didn't want the skirts flapping around when they were running, so they would grab them and wrap them up and tuck them into their belts. And that's the phrase that he uses. Basically, he's like, you need to take take up the skirts and wrap them up and tuck them into your belt of your mind when you're going into battle. You're going to face some things and you need to get it all together, tighten up. Like, in other words, whatever the thing is you're about to face, you need to get your mind focused on a place where you can actually get into that moment and face it. It's a phrase that has to do with training. Set good expectations, know what you're going into, and get ready to and train for the moment that you're going into. That's, I think that's the best kind of way to think about what you're facing. Now, as Jed said, this could have a ton of different permutations based on whatever experiences you're going into, training or getting ready for those things. I used to do these. There's a friend that I have in town who was a Green Beret in the services in the in the Army in the United States. And he would set up these workouts in his like carport. And a bunch of us used to go do those workouts. And this one day, nobody showed up except for me. It was just me and this guy. And so we were doing this workout. It was like before the sun came up or whatever. CrossFit workouts are crazy, y'all. Whatever. If that's your thing, that's so cool. I'm so happy for you. It's ludicrous. But like, I'm doing this CrossFit workout and this guy is like hitting a heavy bag with like boxing gloves. And he calls me by my last name. He's like, "Younger, you're training." And I was like, "For what?" And he was like, "I don't know. But when it happens, you're going to be ready for it." And I was like, "Okay, like, I don't think this is for me." But like, but regardless, like there was a point in there somewhere, which is like, you are going to face things. You don't always know what they are. But like, if you have a goal and a thing that you're heading into, get good advice, adjust your expectations, and do some things that are going to help you face that situation well. And the closest verse that I could find in the Bible is that verse in 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 13, preparing your minds for action. Like, get yourself tightened up and ready to face the thing that you're going to face. I guess that's maybe what this pastor or this book or whatever was maybe talking about, but I think it's great advice in any situation that when you're going into something that you haven't faced, find someone who has and talk to them about it. And then try to figure out what expectations do I have and how should I adjust my expectations? And then are there some things that I need to do to get ready to face this situation? I had never traveled internationally before about 7 years ago. And then when I did, I packed this gigantic bag with like 2 weeks worth of clothes. Well, the bag got lost in an airport. And I realized in that moment, oh, every time from now on, when I travel internationally, I'm going to travel with a carry-on and I'll wash the clothes while I'm there. Well, that's a thing that I've done every single time that I've traveled internationally since that moment. It's an adjustment that I've made about my expectations and it's something that I get ready for. And now that I've taken some of my kids on international travels, I've told them, here's what you're going to do. You're going to get one bag, a carry-on. You're going to put everything you need into that bag and we will wash clothes while you're there. It's just the adjustment of expectations based on experience and then getting yourself ready to face this thing that you've never done before. That is how I consider kind of preparing your heart or preparing your mind for action.
I think that's all great stuff from both of these guys. With that, we are going to move on to our second question. Comes in and says, 1 Corinthians 6 talks about how Christians shouldn't sue each other in front of secular authorities. Not to be blasphemous, but that's crazy, right? That sounds like the kind of thing a church would say to stop someone from speaking out. I think it's a fantastic question. I also think that like 70% of the questions we get have an unspoken, not to be blasphemous tag in them. So it's
sure
fun to see that written out. We welcome
it's a clause.
That.
It's a, yeah, it's a clause in the questions. Yeah.
It's like understand in the terms and agreements. Like if you write into us, like we know you're not, you don't intend to be blasphemous, and that's fine. And we hope you'll serve us the same consideration when it comes to answers. But again, another great question. And Jed, where do we lead off here?
Well, I agree with you. I think you're right. I will now unpack that for you, but I agree with your assessment. I think that Paul is in the middle of a rant in this, and I think that needs to be taken into account. So, like, something that we've talked about many, many times on this podcast is the idea of you need to understand the context of what's going on anywhere in the scriptures to kind of know what your takeaway is. And so that is important here. And part of the context, and this is something that we've brought up a few times over the last couple months, is not everything that you read in the Bible is intended as a, for all times, in all places, in all situations, this is what you should do.
That's right.
Again, you know, quick example, Paul told Timothy, drink a little wine because of your stomach. That is not in any way intended as health advice for the rest of us or a commentary on it. That was a word for one guy in one place. So if you are not familiar with the background here, the church in Corinth was not doing well. And Paul was understandably pretty unhappy about it. And so, they had, to use a phrase, they had lost the plot, man. They were kind of going buck wild, and they had some pretty out there sexual stuff going on. And Paul makes a comment, which I think really, like, if you imagine someone just ranting, that it would really fit, where he's like, you guys are so out of pocket, the people that are not Christians are looking at you and going like, whoa, that should cause you alarm. What is wrong with you? Which, I mean, is fair. You can, you know, kind of read the details for yourself kind of on your own time. But, like, I think Paul is making overall a very broad point about how completely and totally and dramatically the church in Corinth has lost the plot. And given that, I'd be exceptionally cautious about taking his comments here as being prescriptive for all situations. If you've ever ranted at anybody, if you've ever been chewed out in any context, it's very rare that every word of a chew out is intended to be prescriptive for all further situations in your life. Like, if it worked that way, it's not even really a very good chew out. Like, the nature of a chew out is it has to involve at least some hyperbole, or you're not really being chewed out. And if you're not clear, and I think there's a lot of people who've read the Bible that are not clear, Jesus used hyperbole a lot.
Constantly. Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, Jesus was not pro self-mutilation. If you're not clear on that, I would like for us to clear that up right now. When we talked about, you know, if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off, that was not a literal direction. That was using hyperbole to make a broader point.
I don't know, Jed. That sounded pretty hardcore on some blogs in the mid-2010s. So maybe we shouldn't cast that aside so quickly.
Here's a fun anecdote on that. Is in the early church, there was a historian whose name was Origen. And my understanding is he did actually mutilate himself as a part of an effort to abstain from sin, and he recorded his own self. Yeah, it didn't help. And very literally, the early church was like, okay, let that be a lesson to the rest of you. We're not doing that anymore. So let hyperbole be hyperbole.
There had to be one.
That someone was going to do it. I'm glad it wasn't me. I think the
read more about this in every ancient Greek historian's battle, the new hit Christian bestseller.
I think the other thing here, man, that really needs to kind of enter our brains as we consider these things is, you know, you mentioned your question, and it's a great question. Like, you know, it sounds like the kind of thing that a church would say to stop someone from speaking out. I totally get that. Another way of putting that same thing is modern churches are not qualified or set up to or in any way equipped to adjudicate legal disagreements amongst their members. They are not in any way set up to do that at all. Were the churches in Paul's time set up to do that? I have no idea. I wasn't there. But I can absolutely tell you that churches today are not in any way set up to do that at all. So, for example, if someone rear ends you, and there's a thing and it makes sense that there needs to be a lawsuit, like, well, I'm a Christian, you can't sue me. That's not how this works, man.
Nope.
If they're like, well, I'm a Christian, so this would have to go through my church and my pastor will decide. No, buddy, that's not how this is going to work at all. One of the tensions of being a person of faith in any time, but especially in this time, is, man, you live in the world that you live in. To reference Tupac, like, you didn't choose this world. You were born into it. It is what it is. You want to honor the tenets of your faith tradition, but you also have to do so in the context of what is actually actionable and realistic in the world in which you live. And people who would try and cherry pick things out of context, out of the Bible, to insist that you abdicate all of your legal rights, those people are not your friends. So you are right to be cautious and to identify wolves in sheep's clothing. We've got your back. Don't let people con you.
Absolutely right. Also, with the Tupac reference joining several REM references, we are on a guys who grew up in the 90s tear, even by our own standards. Pretty darn good. A lot of excellent stuff there, and especially that last landing point, I think, is the one we need to definitely make sure we are crystal clear about. Look, I have a lot of criticisms of the United States of America and its legal system, but one of the positive things is you can sue pretty much anyone for anything, and then it gets before a judge, and they figure out if it's right or not, and that's about the way it should be. So, Lee, a lot of great stuff from Jed there. What would we add to it?
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, Matt, and that kind of leads me into where I want to go with this response. Jed's exactly right. The church in Corinth was it was kind of a disaster. One of the things that's really interesting, and I'll just go ahead and say this from the front. 1 Corinthians, specifically, to me, is the most difficult book in the New Testament. The most difficult book to understand, the most difficult book to... And that includes the book of Revelation. Within the past few months, I don't know if it was the past few months, within the past half year for sure, Jed gave us a great download on how to think about the book of Revelation and how to look at it and stuff like that. But the book of 1 Corinthians, man, is a complicated situation. And one of the reasons it's so complicated is that this was, exactly as Jed said, a dude ranting to a house church that had about 50 people in it, and they were a hot mess. That is complicated. For every single believer in Jesus for the past 2,000 years to be reading a letter that was delivered to 50 people who were a disaster in a really, really, really out-of-pocket city where everything was super corrupt and super messed up in every corner of the street. Like, one of the things that you need to understand about the legal system in a city like Corinth is it was extremely corrupt, and it always benefited just the most rich and wealthy people possible. And one of the things that Paul is basically saying is, like, dude, you guys are supposed to be a family of love that serves each other and that takes care of the poor, that honors the widow and the foreigner and the immigrant. You're supposed to be like a shining light of love and care and service for everybody else in the world. If you have a problem with each other and you take it to the most corrupt judges in the world, we've already lost our witness. We already are not the people we're supposed to be. Okay, so that's kind of the heartbeat of what he's saying in this. So how do we translate that into the world that we live in today? Well, for a person like me that lives in a state like Tennessee, it's super duper easy for me to translate the idea that Paul is saying to you in 1 Corinthians into real world stuff. Let me give you a super easy example if you lived in the state of Tennessee. Yes, technically in the state of Tennessee, it is legal for every single person to be so afraid of every other human being that they carry a firearm on the outside of their jeans everywhere they go, into the public library and into the Chick-fil-A and into the post office and whatever else. And I think a really good translation of this verse into our modern age is, hey, if you're supposedly a believer in Jesus and you're so afraid of everybody that you're carrying a firearm into a restaurant, we have already blown the whole, we're done. We've blown the whole thing. We have totally blown our witness because we supposedly believe in a God who cares for us, protects us, and loves us, and we supposedly believe in a God who tells us to love everybody and to not be afraid of anybody and to care and serve everybody, especially the poor and especially the immigrant. And if we are going to walk around with guns strapped to our pants because in public spaces where there are children eating like chicken McNuggets, because we're so afraid of everybody, we have completely and totally blown the whole experiment, the whole Christian experiment. Please, if you're going to be that afraid, like everybody else is, and you're going to succumb to stuff like that, please, for the love of all that is holy, don't tell anybody you believe in Jesus, because you're going to sabotage the entire kingdom experiment. I think that would be a very good way of understanding what Paul's getting at here, which is, fellas, folks, ladies and gents, you live in a very corrupt city. It is whack. And people do all kinds of corrupt and whack things. If you do the same stuff that everybody else does there, we have lost, exactly as Jed said, we've lost the plot. So that's just one example. I mean, there we could do so many other examples. I mean, you know, we shouldn't be self-obsessed the way that everybody else is. We shouldn't be so afraid of the future that we're completely greedy and we don't charitably give to anybody else. And if we are self-obsessed, if we are greedy and we don't serve and give to other people, we've lost the plot and we certainly don't need to tell anybody that we supposedly follow Jesus Christ. Because people who follow Jesus Christ should not be afraid the way everybody else is. We should not be greedy and self-obsessed the way that everybody is. I think that would be a helpful way to translate this. If I were making a modern translation of the book of 1 Corinthians, which I would not do, guys, because 1 Corinthians is tough, and I do not think I'm smart enough to do that. But I would translate verses like this in those ways to meet our modern culture. I would say, don't look, man, come on. Don't walk around strapped. Come on, dude. We have lost the plot if we walk around strapped. Come on, man. Don't keep all your stuff for yourself. Come on, dude. There's people that are starving. There's people that don't have any. Dude, there's widows that need help. Come on, man. That's the way I would write this rant in the modern voice if I were to translate the heart of what Paul's getting at here.
I think that's very, very well put and a great example. I really like the idea of somebody who sits in their church and hears a sermon about Daniel in the lion's den or David and Goliath or, you know, any other of these, you know, inspiring, I only need the Lord and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and then making sure they remember to take their Glock into the IHOP for lunch because it's suburban Knoxville. You never know. I mean, sure, if the faith, you can lay down in a lion's den, but what if, you know, what if, you know, and they just kind of keep saying, you know, until the waitress is like, I'm just going to bring you some pancakes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you want the cinnamon syrup or just the regular maple syrup, sir?
Yes. And again, great stuff from both these guys. But then the one point I want to make sure we come back to, they both said it, I just want to make sure it says, obviously, can, if you have legal recourse that you feel you need to take towards someone and they are also a Christian or they are also in your church or they are a leader in your church or they are whatever, you can let the law sort that out. If your employer wrongs you and you have a case against them, to whom they pray has absolutely no bearing on whether or not that's the right thing to do. Now, would it be Christian to not try to ruin a person and get every cent off them you can or get the maximum sentence? Maybe. I don't know. But you have legal rights. The law, at least in the country we're recording this in, big old lefty in theory on this one is meant to make sure that everyone gets a legal playing field and is able to get what they are supposed to have, the protections they're supposed to have. They're supposed to be equally applied. So that is to use those as a positive. And if anyone ever tries to say that, well, so-and-so is such a good Christian or whatever, so you shouldn't go to a lawyer or the police or someone, that's all the way out and we don't have to listen to that. So with that said, Lee, one more thing.
Yeah, I think it's possible for Christians in certain contexts to listen to something like this and feel unsteady about the fact that it sounds like Matt and Lee and Jed are playing fast and loose with the scriptures, and the scriptures are the authority for people who believe in Jesus. That's totally true. I just want to reiterate a point that we've made a few times on this podcast before. The scriptures were written for you. They were not written to you.
Yep.
Yep.
That's a really important distinction to make. They were written for your encouragement. They were written for you to glean wisdom from. They were written for you to figure out through a lifetime of study and working through them what it means to apply these works into your context and into your situation and your relationships. These letters were not written to you. The Apostle Paul is a human being who wrote a specific set of lines to a group of human beings that were not you. And so the goal is, as you work your way through this, to understand their context in such a way that you can apply this to your life. That's why we're trying to come up with some kind of connective tissue between our experience and theirs, because we can't just take every word of this and say, okay, we're not allowed to sue people. Well, the legal system in Corinth has nothing to do with the legal system in whatever, I don't care what country you live in as you listen to this podcast, but it has nothing to do with that legal system, I can promise you. So what we have to do is realize the scriptures are written for me. They were not written to me. Therefore, it is my job to do the hard work of figuring out what does this mean for my context.
Yep, beautifully put. And with that, we're going to move on to our final question here. Comes in and says, people talk about not, quote, trusting the flesh, unquote, but also say we have to discern things. If I'm the one discerning it, aren't I just relying on myself and my flesh? And I think that's a very lucky overlap with what Lee was saying there, because, yes, the idea of, well, you just got to let the word be the word, I think ties into this as well, because I don't know about you, gentlemen. I don't speak Aramaic or ancient Greek. Here's a fun thing. Zero people alive speak ancient Greek. It's a dead language. Everybody's pulling at some threads and trying to make some stuff come together. So similarly here, Jed, this idea of, you can't trust yourself because you're evil and you're a worm, but also, you gotta pray and you gotta discern.
Yeah. No, you're right. You're kind of being fed a weird, inactionable dichotomy. And I can definitely get where that would be like, that seems off.
Also a good metal band name, or maybe Red Heifer's first album, Inactionable Dichotomy.
Yeah, I'm here for that, man. So first let's say the obvious truth. Whatever may be true of God, whatever may be true of the Bible, whatever may be true of the spiritual realm, you as a human being on planet Earth experience things through your brain. That is literally physically, medically true. And so you're going to have to trust your brain on some level, because that's how you experience all forms of reality. And people can tell you all they want about how you can't trust your heart and you can't trust your thoughts and whatnot, but you do, and we all do. And the person who's telling you that, they do as well, because that's literally the only option that any human being on planet Earth has, because that's how the human body works. So we do want to acknowledge that and start there. The second thing that we want to look at, so that idea of trusting the flesh and that we shouldn't do it is very, very likely that people are referring to Philippians chapter 3 there. And that, kind of similar to some of the other stuff that we've talked about today, is a lot of taking one specific thing that one person was saying, kind of making an argument in a particular situation, and then broadening it out in a way that gets pretty weird in a hurry and pretty kind of not livable in a hurry. So I'm not a theologian or a Bible scholar, but when I read Philippians chapter 3, Paul appears to be talking to me, anyway, about not relying on circumcision to save you. That's kind of the big thing that he's starting with. And then he's making a broader point describing how pedigree and bona fides and accomplishments can't save you either. And it turns out that's actually kind of a cool and interesting thing on a couple levels. The first is we can step outside of the realm of spiritual stuff and just bring some discernment in, to use your word, and note that in all kinds of environments and fields of endeavor, cultural markers, education, awards, achievement don't guarantee that a person gets it in all kinds of arenas. One of the weird things that happens in life, and particularly as you get older, is you will meet people, who on paper are like really accomplished in a field of endeavor, and then you will try to work with them and you will say, there is an enormous disconnect between the person that I am dealing with and the resume that they appear to possess. And I'm not sure how we landed there, but that's definitely where we're at. I not to tell tales out of school, but man, I can tell you, I've known a lot of people in my life where there was an enormous disconnect between their resume on paper and the extent to which they did or did not understand how to do that field. So that's a thing that happens, and that's at least part of what Paul is describing here. Is people are like, oh no, we've got this God thing down pat, man. And I'd like to tell you about my degrees and my, you know, this and my that and the whole thing. And Paul's saying, no, dude, you're totally missing the point. Like you're not getting at all how this God thing works. So now, for a second, let's talk about how this God thing works. And despite the efforts of a lot of evangelical theologians for a long time to make this into a thing where you're supposed to hate yourself and think that you're awful, 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 so much that you can't even trust any of your own thoughts, let's throttle back on that for a second. Right now, Hallie and I are a foster home for a dog. It is Pancake the Pit Bull. And the thing about Pancake the Pit Bull is she's great. Like, she's not a perfect dog, because I don't know what that would mean, and I'm sure that doesn't exist. And does she sin in that she sometimes falls short of the mark? I guess, yeah, because she's not a perfect dog, but I love her anyway. Because she's great. I just love her because she's awesome. And I want you to imagine with me for a moment that I wake up tomorrow and Pancake can talk, which would be pretty funky. I hope that happens. And if Pancake came to me and said, Jed, I did not chew on any of your shoes overnight, so now you have to love me. I have merited your love. You are required to love me because I did not chew on any of your shoes. What I would explain to Pancake is, I'm glad you didn't chew on my shoes, but that's not how love works. Like, I love you because I do. And even if you had chewed on my shoes, I would still love you, because that no one merits love. No one earns love. No one is such a good girl that they get love because I have no other option. Like, it's a business arrangement. That's not how love works. And I think that is a big part. Here's the beautiful thing about the Christian faith tradition is we believe in a God who loves you because he does. Yeah. And yes, he has paid the price. He has done the things so that whatever could be in the way isn't. And given that he's done that, now we can focus on the fact he loves you because he does. And if you were to go to God constantly, either talking about all the reasons why he shouldn't love you, or talking about all the reasons why he's required to love you because of how amazing you are, we would be completely missing the point of what that relationship is supposed to be. And there wouldn't be much of a relationship. Like, Again, if Pancake the Pitbull learned to talk and all of our interactions involved her explaining, well, I have merited food by not gnawing on anything, so you have to feed me now, that would be a weird and off-putting relationship to have with a dog. So when you look at this passage, I think what you have is Paul making one point that, you know, makes sense and is a part of the overall, you know, the standard Christian view of things. But then you have a lot of people who came after Paul that wanted to be hardcore and take it to the limit and write a book and convince you how smart they are and how theologically savvy they are, who have turned this into something way past what I think Paul intended and way past the point of sanity, because we're at a point where we're saying you have to use your brain to hear the words I'm saying, but you can't trust your brain because it's an evil, wicked, naughty brain. So you should listen to the words that I'm saying, but you shouldn't trust any of your other thoughts because they come from your evil, wicked, naughty brain. Please don't note the huge throbbing disconnect in what I just said.
Well, then I won't. What I will say is that I greatly appreciate not only Jed's wisdom in that answer, but also his backdoor pitch for the Saturday morning TV show where Pancake the Pitbull gains the gift of speech and then immediately starts trying to uncover theological depths, and Jed has to rein it back in.
Yeah.
The other thing out of that is, Jed, I'm not really into the end time stuff, but if your dog starts talking on eclipse day, I'm going to get a little concerned. That's a little bit too much coincidence for me. But that being said, all the great stuff in the answer. And Lee, where do we close this one out?
I want to respond to the question, but I'm just a huge fan of Pancake the Pitbull right now.
Right?
That's all I'm thinking about. Now, this is a great question, and I think it's the thing I love about this podcast and the folks who listen to it is the courage to say, I heard this weird Christian thing. It's freaking me out. What's that about? And to me, that's been the kind of the hallmark of this entire experiment for 12, 13 years, however long we've been doing this. But in the scriptures, the term the flesh is it's a shorthand term for this concept of me on my own. It's just me without any help. Me in my natural state, just me with no God in my life and no wisdom in my life and nobody, anybody else. It's kind of like, in psychology terms, it's just like your id. It's like me and my lizard brain. There's stuff that I want that I don't even think about that. I just want it. I just want it right now. And that's kind of this, that term, the flesh, in these New Testament writers, it's shorthand for that kind of concept. And the wisdom of the scriptures, and we've talked about this so many times on this podcast, the discernment that is involved in the wisdom of that the scriptures talks about is the kind of decision making that comes from several different sources, which is just kind of like, it's the idea of slowing down the cognition. I'm just going to slow down. I'm going to ask some advice, which we talked about this in the first question. I'm going to ask some advice. I'm going to pray about this, and I'm going to weigh some options. And that's just a completely different way of making decisions than, like, you know, just me on my own. I'm just going to do whatever comes natural, whatever I'm feeling in the moment. Versus the kind of biblical wisdom that says, do I know an expert in this? Will I take time to think about this? Will I pray and get some direction from the Spirit on this? It's when I think about the difference between, you know, the concept of acting on the flesh or being led by the Spirit, you know, seeking discernment. For me, it's a question of speed. Like, how fast am I going on my decision making? Am I going to go right now on the thing that I most want in this second, or am I going to take time to call a couple of my friends, or to seek some advice, or to pray about it, or to take a walk, make a cup of tea, relax, maybe take a nap? Like, those are the kinds of things. It's like, am I going to take a beat on this? and seek out some wisdom. Discernment versus the flesh, I think, has a lot to do with timing. It has a lot to do with taking a minute to collect some sources. I'm going to pray. I'm going to wait. I'm going to seek an expert, and I'm going to take some time versus just, I'm going to jump on this thing right now. This is what I want to do. I don't know about you, dear listener, but I know for me, there are times when I just flat out, I'm doing this. I don't care. Sometimes those things are innocuous, and sometimes they work out very badly for me. But a lot of times, I pretty much know the difference, and I know what it feels like. And I also know that sometimes the reason that I don't want to seek out expert advice, the reason that I don't want to take my time, is that I don't want to know what the answer is, because I've already made my mind up what I want to do. I don't even want to place any amount of shame on that or guilt on that or anything like that. I think that makes a lot of sense. It's extremely natural and all that kind of stuff. But I think discernment, there's a humility in discernment, which is, it involves going to someone else and saying the words, I don't know. What do you think? And so if I'm willing to have the humility of discernment of saying, I don't know, what do you think? I think that's a very helpful way to think about it, is discernment requires humility, and discernment requires a little bit more time. Other than that, I mean, and I may be completely off on, this scripturally, like some theologian or something, or a scholar may tell me that's not what flesh means at all. I just know that as far as my personal experience, discernment takes time and discernment takes humility. It takes a willingness to say, I don't know, and a willingness to say, can someone help me? And a willingness to pump the brakes and to take a little time.
It's all fantastic stuff from both of these guys here. One thing I would add on the discernment side is, I think that is another word that does kind of get abused. It is an actual concept, both spiritually and just in the world. To discern things is good, but as Lee points out there, it is not the idea that I will concentrate super hard or be super holy and go to the mountaintop and get the one true answer to this thing or all right. things. That's not what discernment is. Discernment is using the tools you have. Hopefully that's other people. Hopefully that's someone in a counseling or a leadership role that you trust. And yes, that is also your own thoughts and reasoning faculties to come up with a next step. That doesn't mean you will figure out everything out at once. That doesn't mean everything will be the best possible answer. There are plenty of scenarios in life where there's no real best possible answer. There's no 100% on the test. There's just doing the next step to get where you can with what you've got. And then discernment is a big part of that. And I think the idea that things can still be messy and still be not entirely feel super holy or super smart, but you can still be doing discernment right, is one of the things that is least discussed about that and something that I find helpful. All right. If you have a question for us, say that podcast at gmail.com, thebridgechicago.tumblr.com. Take out the song. This is, we started talking about the loud music. We'll go out with it. This is from our friends from previous sister program, The Bridge Loud, with a version of Jed's song, Bigger Than My Fears. Take out that. Thanks for listening. Just more. We love you. God loves you. There's nothing you can do about it.